Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. Subscribe to SubChina's daily, newly designed China Access newsletter to keep on top of all the latest news from China from hundreds of different news sources. Or check out all the original writing on our website at subchina.com. We've got reported stories, essays and editorials, great explainers and trackers, regular columns, and of course, a growing library of podcasts. We cover everything from China's fraught foreign relations to its ingenious entrepreneurs, from the ongoing repression of Uyghurs and other Muslim peoples in China's Xinjiang region, to China's travails as it wrestles with a surging wave of COVID-19. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. We cover China with neither fear nor favor. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Since the Russian invasion of Ukraine on February 24th of this year, we've talked quite a bit on this show about Chinese public opinion, but thus far, we've mostly had to rely on anecdotal evidence, on the intuitions or the general sense that various scholars and pundits have from their social media feeds or from conversations they've had with their interlocutors, be they from China or from Russia or elsewhere, and what they can infer from patterns of censorship, for example, in China. This week on Seneca, we'll be taking a look at some of the actual public opinion research, and not just on Chinese attitudes toward the war, but also on attitudes among people in China, the U.S., and Russia toward one another, and more. Joining me to discuss is Yawei Liu Yawei, the senior advisor on China at the Carter Center in Atlanta. Yawei, welcome back to Seneca.
Thanks. Thank you for inviting me back to talk about this important issue.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. Listeners may recall that we had Yawei on in, I think it was November of last year, to talk about some survey research that the Carter Center had commissioned through RIWI, a Toronto-based survey research outfit that's using really innovative methods to acquire their data. Well, they have teamed up with RIWI again on a new batch of research. This time, I've also asked Danielle Goldfarb, who is head of global research at RIWI, to come onto the show and talk about the work that they did with the Carter Center, but also about other highly relevant survey data that they've done recently. Danielle joins us from Toronto. Danielle, welcome to Seneca.
Thanks for having me.
I'm delighted that you could be here. Yawei, let me start with you and ask, why does public opinion even matter in an authoritarian country where, you know, there isn't this mechanism, the ballot box, by which popular opinion can be, you know, made manifest in actual policy? Why is it important that we understand how ordinary Chinese people think about something like the war in Ukraine?
Well, it matters in the sense that, you know, they still claim their system is people's democracy, right? They like to say everything the government does is in accordance with the will of the people. But you also oftentimes hear Chinese diplomats making the announcement that even though we don't do poll, but you know, there is public opinion in China, and that public opinion sometimes makes it very hard to make decisions. Right. So in that context, it is also very important. Social media in China has certainly provided a radar screen on how vibrant that public opinion is, although that public opinion to a large extent can be manipulated by the censorship regime in China.
Indeed, indeed. And what did you set out to find with this latest set of questions? What were the top level questions that you had for Riwi in this set of research?
So it was a quick decision to conduct this survey because we initially published the op-ed by Professor Hu Wei from Shanghai. You know, he strongly disagreed with the government position. So that made us think, you know, is Hu Wei's opposition to the government position a reflection of the popular viewpoint of the war? So, you know, obviously Hu Wei is a scholar. He's not even an international relationship scholar. He's known for introducing the concept of intra-party democratization. So that prompted us to do it. So the most important question we want to ask, and which is the question really will help us to ask, is what do you think China's support for Russia's war in Ukraine is in the interest of China's national security?
So that was the top question that you asked. And there were another couple that you decided to tack on, which were also really, really interesting.
Right. The other question we ask is, have you seen the accusation that Americans are operating biolabs in Ukraine? If you have seen it, do you believe it is accurate? If you have not seen it, do you believe it is accurate? So that's the second question we ask those that are being polled.
Yeah, fascinating. I think we should just take a quick aside here and talk a little bit about the article that you referenced by Hu Wei, because this was something that got the Carter Center and the U.S.-China Perception Monitor sort of a bit of attention, not of the necessarily the favorable kind. In fact, your website was blocked after you published a translation of this. So Hu Wei is vice chairman of the Public Policy Research Center of the Counselor's Office of the State Council. So he's no small fry. I mean, he's somebody quite serious. What you've done, I think it's interesting because since the outbreak of the war, you've been kind of gamely trying to show that the debate within China over how Beijing should respond, the position that China should ultimately take with respect to the war, that debate has not yet been entirely shut down. And you've kept this going even after the website was blocked, after you got a lot of pushback about publishing his piece. Now, to be clear, I definitely share your view. I have talked to multiple Chinese diplomats and academics, and the discourse, I would say, is not as closed as some people might have been trying to lead us to believe. Like you, I have pushed back against the idea that in China there is no level of support for Russia that is too high, and no expression of sympathy for Ukraine is allowed. That's just really not the case. A recent example of this, I mean, while we're on the subject, I think it's maybe important that we bring this up. You tweeted about a couple of essays. One of them was a pro-Russian essay by a guy named Lin Zhibo, which was actually censored for being too stridently pro-Russian. And then there was a response by a guy named Cheng Mo, which I assume is probably a pen name, which wasn't censored, if I'm not mistaken. Can you talk about these two posts really quickly and give us your sense of maybe where you think that currently the allowable discourse, online at least, about Ukraine is in China?
I think in the early days of the war, the censorship is such that you can only read or hear pro-Russia opinions. I think probably by the time we published Hu Wei, and probably after that, the criticism of Russia, the criticism of China's outright pro-Russia position is being debated. That voice is allowed. So Lin Zhibo, as you mentioned, is a real person. You know, he actually is a reporter for the People's Daily. He's don't know if he's still running, you know, sort of the office, the People's Daily office in Sichuan. So his diatribe, you know, so critical of the U.S., so critical of the West, and makes the argument that China and Russia is the most progressive force in the world. And in this eventual showdown, with the West, led by the United States. You know, China is going to be China and Russia, and the progressive forces represented by them will be on the winning side. So it really correlates with the so-called time and momentum are on our side, you know, the rise of the East and the decline of the West. But I guess, you know, that claim is so ardent and talking about how Russia's war against Ukraine is so just that eventually, you know, they're going to win. Maybe it's too far for the government to be associated with that position. And given the fact that he himself works for a media outlet. So that's why. So I was searching for it. Most of the mainstream websites, particularly where it was first published, the Guanchaowang, operated by the, you know, the Fudan Group, the China Institute Group, you know, Zhang Weiwei and Eric Li. It was gone from there. It was gone from the Fenghuang website. But eventually I found it on one of the most leftist website called the Red Song website. It's still there. I don't know why it was able to be left alone there. And the other article, I agree with you, Cheng Mo is probably, we don't know his true identity. Mm-hmm. You know, Lin Zhibo, basically his article is long. It's divided into 18 sections. But Cheng Mo's article is not a direct response to the article we talked about. He actually tried to answer 32 questions related to the war in Ukraine. But he doesn't want to talk about the relationship between China and the war. And what's most amazing about this article is the disinformation that being widely distributed in China. For example, that President Zelensky, he looks very energetic, but he's actually supported by drugs. That you know, the destruction of the Russian cruise missile, you know, was a fire. You know, it was not destroyed.
The Moskva, the missile cruiser, right?
I think there's a lot of those kind of informations that are popular in China. He tried to debunk them all, but he doesn't want to get into the position to say that the Chinese government position is not a sustainable position.
I see. So he doesn't go after directly Beijing stated policy. He doesn't go after directly. He just goes after a lot of the misinformation that's out there circulating.
I think one thing he does go against the other article is that the Russians' slow pace of occupying Ukraine has a lot to do with their care for the life of the civilians. And he said, no, that's not the case. If you care to look at what happened in Bukha and what happened in Mariupol, you're not going to say anything like that. So he is against Lin Zhibo on that front.
Okay. All right. So that was an interesting side, but let's get back into the actual survey data that you guys did. So before we dig into the results commissioned actually by the Carter Center, Danielle, perhaps you could remind listeners who don't remember or who didn't hear our show with Yahweh and his colleague Michael from November, remind us how RIWI conducts its surveys and how that addresses some of the problems that we ordinarily encounter when we're trying to do survey research in countries like China in particular.
Absolutely. So Yahweh has already pointed out some of the issues involved with, you know, for example, getting data from social media. You know, got big data there, but a lot of that can be censored, and you're hearing really from the most vocal people. And there's obviously, you know, social desirability bias to express views in a certain way. We know that, you know, email, another way that you typically get data would be through a typical panel where you have, you know, people who are incentivized to a kind of a narrow group of people that are paid and habitual survey takers. And what we're doing at RIWI is we're trying to address biases, minimize the biases associated with some of those conventional approaches. And the way that we do that is by using a technology called random domain intercept technology. And it's sort of like, I don't know, for those of you who remember, who are listening, that remember landlines where people would, you know, randomly pick a number out of the phone book and call this called random digit dialing. It's the analog for the internet. So we're basically, you know, randomly intercepting people online. And the way we do that is we have hundreds and thousands of parked but inactive web domains that are kind of rotating at any one time. And they might, you know, you might come across an error message if you're surfing the web. And if we happen to occupy one of those web domains at that time, then you would be exposed to a survey. And by doing that in this kind of, in this randomized fashion, where anybody who is online has the potential of receiving one of these surveys, and therefore we're getting access to people that are non-typical survey takers. So in China, when we survey our respondents, we know that 60% of them tell us they've never taken a survey before. You know, more than 80% haven't taken one in the past month. It's really people that are from all parts of the country, not just tier one and tier two cities, tier three, tier four, rural. If you have a smartphone, we can access you, any device, you know, smartphone, desktop, tablet. Sometimes even people respond on Teslas. And so that way we're really accessing people that are not typical survey takers. And the other feature that's really important about the way we gather data in China, and I should just also mention, we're in every country of the world except for North Korea. So we're, you know, we work in places where it's difficult to get more reliable information.
Right.
And when there's restricted information environments. And one really key feature of the technology and the approach is that, again, with conventional survey methodologies, if you're incentivizing someone, you need to get their contact information. You need to somehow be able to give them that incentive. We don't want to collect any personally identifiable information because we want to minimize the chance that people will lie and maximize the chance that they're going to be honest. And so we don't collect any personally identifiable information. So it's really, truly anonymous.
Yeah. Are you willing to share maybe some examples that you could cite where Riwi's approach yielded maybe a better sense of public opinion than maybe more traditional polling methods did? I can think of a couple of times where we've been pretty badly led astray by polling data, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the most obvious examples, so, you know, Riwi's done all kinds of things from the original application was for pandemic monitoring during a different pandemic, but it's been applied to all sorts of global events. And the main ones that sort of come up as places where conventional polls did not do the trick, they led us astray. So, you know, one example is the Brexit vote. And in that case, the conventional polls basically anticipated that more people would come out and vote, but vote against Brexit. But what they didn't do is they didn't speak to all the disengaged young people who didn't plan to come out and vote. And so when we use the Riwi methodology, in fact, you know, we had a bunch of academics who were looking into this before the Brexit vote. And they said, look, you know, these young people cannot be counted on to come vote. You got to speak to these young people. The conventional polls are not accessing those people. And then the other big example, of course, is what was, you know, supposedly a surprise election win for President Trump in 2016. But the Riwi technology was able to tap into those Trump voters and able to say, look, we actually call a Trump election in 2016. And similarly, in 2020, the methodology actually said that, you know, this is going to be a much closer election than the polls predicted. And actually, in the French election, we also were also able to get data that was much closer to the actual result than conventional polls did. So we've got a lot of examples of where this has worked to be able to access people who are not typically sharing their opinion. And we're doing it on all kinds of conflict zone, all kinds of places all around the world.
So you guys have all these domains that people hit, you're parked on, and people hit them, and instead of the usual error message, they are asked to take a quick survey, right?
Yeah.
Do you know whether some of the URLs that you have are URLs that are, say, blocked in China, or are you perhaps able to get sites that you know to be blocked in China and somehow redirect inbound traffic from Chinese IP addresses to those surveys?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the kinds of web domains that we are using, that we are occupying for, you know, could be a very short period of time, they are the ones that are inactive. So, you know, in the US, like facebook.com, you know, that's an active domain. We would not be using that domain.
Of course.
We are using inactive domains. So, you know, website, it's blocked in China. We're not using that domain, but we may be using other domains that, you know, if people, whatever they're searching for, if they come across an error message, then we'd potentially be occupying that domain. And we rotate these domains so that they're really representative of the web using population. And so that each day we're capturing a new random cohort of the population. That gives us confidence. if they tell us the same thing, you know, day after day, that we're getting something reliable.
Fantastic. So I guess let's take a look now at the findings from the Carter Center's Commission questionnaire. You guys set out to look at levels of support for Russia and opinions about China's best course of action. That was another one. And that was really an interesting one because you gave one set of questions that asked that gave them the option China steps in as some kind of a mediator, and the other that didn't give them that option, that was sort of various ways in which to support or not. And then the third question really was about this disinformation piece. What were the specific questions that you asked respondents, and what was the general distribution of answers?
So basically, the first question is whether China's support for Russia is in China's interest. I think I'm quite surprised by the outcome, because before the survey, I was thinking, you know, if you're watching, you know, both the state and social media news, if you care about where China is today, and if you think about, you know, where China is going to go after they are so steadfast in their support of Russia, you know, what is going to happen to China. So I was hoping that, you know, at least probably there will be a divided kind of opinion, but it's largely one-sided. So 75% of those that are polled believes that China's support for Russia is in China's interest. So on the second question, in terms of the best course of action, you mentioned, you know, it's actually a divided question. So the first part is we don't have the option of China play a role of mediation. So on that is 61% of those that are polled basically say China should offer moral support. So those who believe that China should provide military support, that percentage is very low. And then we introduce the option of China playing a mediation role, then 58% of those polled basically said China should play a role of mediation. I think the answers to these two questions at least tells us that, you know, the Chinese, those that are polled, you know, they are clear-eyed about what this support is all about. It's more about moral support. It will be stupidity for China to get militarily engaged. And of course, they probably don't know much about how China is being warned by Biden and by the European leaders that, you know, if any material support you offer that can be interpreted as sustaining the war effort, then you're going to face consequences. So I'm comforted by this finding. And finally, on the biolab, the conspiracy theory, if you ask them, have you seen this? Those who have seen this, I think 72% believe these accusations are real, that Americans are operating biolabs. COVID-19 probably originated from there. And for those who have not read anything about this, as high as 51% of those polled believe that this is true.
Oh, God, Christ. I mean, for anyone who hasn't followed this, so Chinese state media and even some foreign ministry spokespeople have pushed this idea that Russian troops in Ukraine discovered supposedly American-funded or even American-operated biological labs and have suggested that they were actually working on bioweapons. It strikes me that this particular claim out of Moscow was repeated and found resonance in China for one central reason, and that is that, you know, Beijing and the Chinese public more broadly is still really, really resentful over the so-called lab leak theory of COVID origins. And the, you know, the conflation, the kind of deliberate conflation of that with bioweapons, and they're smarting from that, and it feels a little vindictive. It also, I mean, if I were maybe conspiratorially minded about the origins of conspiracy theories, I would even think that maybe this was tailor-made for Chinese consumption. Like if I were in Moscow and I wanted to get Chinese people all riled up against the United States with a conspiracy theory, I would create one about bioweapons labs in Ukraine. anyway, what did you feel about that? What was your sense about this? And what was really striking, Yahweh, as you said, was that the higher level of education people had, the more apt they seemed to be to believe this disinformation, which seems completely contradictory to what you and me might have suspected beforehand.
Yes, I think there seems to be a correlation that the higher the level of the education, the more likely they believe in the conspiracy theories, the more likely they think supporting Russia is in China's national interest, which, you know, is and also I think the consumption of both state and social media. So this may be an indication is how social media has been synchronized to the state media outlet. You know, on the conspiracy theory, I want to add, I think early on, even right after the SARS outbreak, you know, there are Chinese IR scholars, you know, particularly the retired senior colonel Dai Xu, basically made the claim that SARS was a biological warfare against China launched by the United States. You know, at the time, there are reporters who ask, you know, can you provide the evidence? He said, I have evidence, but I'm not going to share this with you. And more recently, I think other sort of RI scholar think tank researchers claim, you know, what happened in Hong Kong is orchestrated by the U.S. And then what happened in Shanghai is orchestrated by the U.S. And, you know, the goal, of course, is to use a pandemic and China's approach to this, you know, to weaken China's economy. So this I think from the top all the way to the elite and then to the people that we have polled, there is this tendency to believe in general that the U.S. has this goal, not only just to contain China, but to make China disintegrate, just like what happened to the Soviet Union. So I think the finding here is consistent with this kind of conspiracy environment. You know, when you hear China, you know, the Chinese government, foreign ministry spokesperson accuse Americans instigating the protest in Hong Kong. You know, this is basically this, anything critical of the government, anything critical of the government and policies, you know, they are not from our people, because our people being misled, our people being instigated, as if, you know, Chinese people themselves have no agency at all on these issues.
It's the standard authoritarian victim narrative going on here. Yeah. So, Danielle, in these surveys, it's clear that you have some demographic data on them, probably gender, age, education level. It's also clear you get some kind of sense of their level of exposure to state media, social media, these sorts of things. Is this all just self-reported, or do you have other means by which you can gather this demographic stuff?
Yeah, that's a good question. So as soon as somebody clicks on, as soon as somebody's exposed to the survey and decides to click and start to answer the survey, we auto-detect their location.
Right.
And we also know what device they're responding on, their operating system, et cetera. So like, you know, if they tell us they're never going to buy an Apple iPhone, you know, an iPhone again, but they're responding on an iPhone, we would have that information, which was useful during, you know, parts of the China-US trade war. We also, though, then ask them for self-reported information, age, gender, and then various other demographic information, income, education. And then we can test, you know, it depends what the study is, but we can test their level of exposure to state media. And as, you know, as we talked about in this study, their exposure to certain kinds of myths or disinformation.
But you don't get stuff like their browser history or anything like that?
Not their browser history, but we can tell, we do have a lot of kind of machine data on what they're doing. But what we don't have is their anything that personally identifies them. And so we can't go back to the same person again and ask them the same question because of our anonymity. But we do get quite a bit of machine data, and we definitely know where they are. Like, you know, are they in Shanghai under lockdown right now? Like, we would know that somebody is answering us from Shanghai.
Danielle, staying with you for a bit, let's talk about this military conflict risk index and especially about the China-Taiwan pairing. First of all, like I said, there are a couple of other studies that I wanted to talk about here, and you had done them for another client, and presumably you're talking about this with his permission. Can you talk a little bit about who that was at Bank of America, I believe, right?
Sure, yeah. Actually, it's a suite of kind of data feeds that we're creating that are available for subscription. So we're doing them together with David Wu. David Wu is a former macro strategist at the Bank of America. And the idea was that, you know, geopolitical risk is, you know, the number is big right now. We started putting this together before Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but really the idea that, you know, there isn't a lot of good real-time information on what is happening in terms of the you know, major conflicts, China-Taiwan, Russia-Ukraine, Iran-Israel, you know, India-Pakistan. And we wanted to have some real-time intelligence from citizens as kind of an alternative source of information to really get, you know, citizens are closest to the activity on the ground. They are hearing the information from their leaders, and they know, you know, whether there things are happening, whether they're required to, you know, report for military duty and so on. And so the idea was to hear from the broadest array of citizens possible in real time in both of these conflict zones to be able to, in both of the countries of the pairing, to be able to see, okay, is the risk of escalation, you know, is there an increased risk of escalation in this conflict, or are things de-escalating? And so, you know, well, we heard from the Ukrainians and Russians in the, you know, the week before the invasion, yes, things are happening, and we're hearing the same thing. We actually didn't hear that over the course of March. Ukrainians and Russians thought things were actually going to stay stable, but now we're seeing, you know, since the beginning of April, that they are saying things are going to intensify. So it's really it's an alternative source of information on what's happening on the ground in these conflicts, basically.
So focusing, of course, as we would for this show, on the China-Taiwan pairing. I mean, it's a shame that people can't see right in front of them right now the graph of the 7-day moving average that you did. Maybe with your permission, I could put that in the show notes. That would be great.
Sure. Yeah.
But basically, you asked people in Taiwan and on the Chinese mainland whether they thought military tensions across the Taiwan Strait would likely increase or decrease in the coming weeks. And they answered on a 5-point scale, which you graphed from -2 to 2. And what's fascinating to me, though, and I think probably to anyone looking at this, is that they track so closely. I mean, Taiwan
Absolutely.
Remains consistently above the PRC on this question, but it tracks together. I mean, they put the likelihood at a higher level, but it rises and falls with what people answer on the mainland in very, very tight sync. What does that mean? What do we can we infer from that?
Well, first of all, you also the it's also notable that there is, you know, a lot. I think in the public discourse, there's some concern that there could be an escalation of this conflict. And according to Chinese and Taiwanese citizens, we're actually seeing that, you know, they think the risk of things escalating has actually decreased since the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
And they're quite substantially. Yeah.
And quite, yes. And so I think that's the first kind of takeaway. And then the second, like you pointed out, is this, you know, that they're basically kind of responding to the same narrative, the same set of narratives that are out there about this conflict. So, you know, it looks to me like you're right. It like they almost track when anything happens, you can see that it's going that this is happening in parallel. And because we're doing this every day, repeating the same question every day to a new random cohort, and it's really remarkable how much they're aligned.
Another question that you asked in the work that you did with David Wu was about the likely impact that the conflict was going to have and whether that's more economic in nature or political in nature. That is, will it affect the economy, relative economic power of the country in question, or will it affect the political system? And I thought it was really interesting too.
Yeah, we were basically trying to ask, you know, what's at stake in this crisis,
right?
Not in the crisis, in this broader geopolitical conflict between, you know, Russia and China and its and their allies and the U.S., Europe and its allies. And we gave people a range of options, and the, you know, 36% of Chinese, 36% of Russians, and 37% of Americans think that what's most at stake in this global power struggle is the prospect for economic power for their country. And the least selected option was that political systems were at stake. And this is it's very interesting also because, you know, it's sort of this new, you know, what some people are calling the new Cold War. It's really about economics. It's not, you know, the world is just much more tightly integrated now, and it's a different set of issues. I mean, not completely different, but really citizens in all these countries recognize that what's really at stake is the economic success of their countries. And on the one hand, you could find this kind of disconcerting because, you know, economics is not supposed to be a zero-sum game, right? Like if we've learned anything from economic history and theory and so on, it is that, you know, we all benefit
by trading,
you know, right? And so, you know, but that's kind of the finding that we get. And I think you said that you didn't think it was that surprising, Kaiser.
No, I don't think it's surprising. Partially, I'm glad at this outcome. Yes, I am concerned they didn't learn about the Edgeworth box in Econ 101 as well as they should have, maybe, and how all trade is supposed to be mutually beneficial. But what does sort of maybe give me some heart is that they're not swallowing this narrative that people are pushing in Beijing and in Washington, that this is a primarily ideological struggle, that this isn't autocracy versus democracy necessarily, that there's... I mean, if I had to hazard a guess as to why people in China would reject that narrative, is that I think a lot of people in China simply don't believe that China intends, even if it wins this, as it were, to push its political system onto anybody. I mean, and those who do think that political systems are at stake here are answering that question maybe defensively, because, you know, it doesn't specify whether it thinks that, you know, political change will come to them. It could also be to us, right? And they do believe that the U.S. wants to foist its political system onto China. Russians probably feel the same way. And Americans are, you know, they're still locked into this idea that economic power automatically brings about systemic political change. So, I mean, that would be my kind of stab at a like 10-second theory of it. But anyway, it fascinating results. Yahweh, I imagine that many people would be surprised by the results that you have that show this whole higher education being correlated with higher support for Russia. I mean, it's really hard for me still. I mean, I know you've offered a little bit of an explanation, but why is it so hard for me to shake this longstanding belief that China's educated urbanites are somehow more cosmopolitan and therefore more, you know, maybe Western leaning than the rest of society? Is it time to retire that idea?
No, I don't think it's time to retire that idea. I think this correlation, the higher level of education, the more likelihood they believe, you know, in conspiracy theories or believe that China's support for Russia, the war in Ukraine is in China's national interest. I think, as I tried to explain earlier, so there are multiple factors here. Number one, of course, is what I said, is the monopoly of the both the state and social media, you know, by the propaganda apparatus. Number two, I think this is a true reflection. You know, it's kind of we can take into consideration Daniel's talked about the findings of, you know, this U.S.-China competition or rivalry is not about ideology. It's really about containing China. So I think I've mentioned this in other places. I think there is this October Revolution moment in China, the China's elite. More and more of them start to believe that U.S. now is hostile to China. What U.S. is trying to do has nothing to do with ideology or human rights or anything like that. You know, it's more about to make China, to paralyze China's economic growth, you know, to deny China the crown jewel of innovation and technologies, and to basically make China disintegrate. You know, the ramification of this is going to be serious. If we go back to 100 years before President Woodrow Wilson failed to deliver Jiaodong Peninsula to China after Germany was defeated, that caused widespread disillusionment and disappointment in President Woodrow Wilson, in Western liberal democracy. At the same time, Moscow issued a declaration saying they're going to return all the territory seized from the Qing court to China. So that created a pivot in China, which was before they think liberal democracy, just like what Japan was able to do, is use Western institutions, you know, to strengthen your country. So at that point, you know, they made a sharp turn around, and many like Mao and other founding members of the party to believe that the Soviet way is the best way for China. So this is what I'm concerned most now is U.S. best asset in this competition with China is what you mentioned, the elite positive perception of the U.S. is now going through a sea change. And once...
So here we are in 1919 again, right?
Exactly.
The eve of the May 4th movement. And you think that this profound disillusionment that the liberal intelligentsia, I mean, everybody, I mean, these guys like Chen Duxiu and Li Dajiao were all, you know, committed liberals. They were not, you know, so enamored with Marxism yet, but this was a pivotal moment.
Right.
That's I think profoundly interesting argument.
One of the popular tweets by Liu Xin, you know, the anchor woman for CGTN, mm-hmm. you know, her tweet is that, you know, you want us to destroy our friend and then you turn around to destroy us. I think that that's a reflection of not the majority, but I think a significant portion of the people, you know, particularly in the international relations communities, that they think because U.S. is such that, you know, we have to hedge. We have to have a friend. You know, what if we're not going to have any friend around when U.S. Starts real decoupling with China?
So, Yaowei and Danielle, I'm not sure who's best suited to answer this, but where did you find pockets of opposition to the war? I mean, are there demographics, identifiable segments of Chinese society where opposition to the war or a desire for China to stay out of it completely or to even side with NATO and the United States with Ukraine, was that found to be slightly higher? Is there such a place in the demography of China right now?
I don't know if Danielle has a better interpretation of that. I think statistically, if you look at, because the percentage is small, it's hard to identify. But anecdotally, I think there is this big divide between the popular view, how the public views the war and how international relations scholars see the war. So anecdotally, I was told, you know, in the international relations scholar community, more than 50%, probably as high as 65% of the scholars agree with Huwei's view. So
right,
if that's the case, then, you know, that's a sharp contrast that at the elite level, you know, people seem to have more comprehensive understanding of what China's support for Russia means. Whereas at the lower level, they don't seem to be able to have accurate answers to that question. Or, you know, how do you calculate cost and decision making?
Yeah, it's pretty tough. I mean, in this study, it was like N equals 4,800 something. This is not a small study, but I'm sure you weren't able to get so granular that you could say, this person has a PhD in political science. Or Danielle, you were going to say?
So I was going to say that we asked in my country, you know, people view the Russia-China relationship. And one thing we observed is that the Chinese were less likely to actually say that it was an allied relationship than the Russians were. And so I think that's also an important kind of indicator, which is kind of complementary perhaps to the sort of the, you know, some of the things that Yaowei found in the Carter Center study. Yeah, I think that's, and we also found that in the U.S.-China relationship, you know, again, it's not as adversarial as you might think when you ask regular people from across both countries. But young people, again, were more open to the idea of a coexisting kind of relationship rather than a more adversarial one. So that I find a little bit optimistic.
That's encouraging. I mean, I'm curious because, you know, your survey results show that more Americans view the U.S. relationship with Russia as one of adversaries or enemies than view the relationship with China as
Correct.
Such. Yeah. I wonder what that was like before February 24th. I wonder if the war has really changed that. Because, I mean, if you go back, I looked at the Pew Global Attitudes, which is, you know, sort of the standard benchmark, and they only have data to 2020. But in 2020, China had a much higher unfavorability score than Russia did among Americans. The terms are not the same, of course, but I do think this is significant. Does Riwi have data from before February 24th on this Cold War II thing?
Unfortunately, on this particular question, oh, actually, sorry, I might be able to dig some out for you.
That'd be great.
But I don't have the answer off the top of my head, because we did, when Russia invaded Ukraine, we pivoted. And in fact, we were actually going to do a China-US index, and then we pivoted to a Cold War II index.
Yeah.
So I do have some historical data. I don't have it up off the top of my head. But, you know, yeah, so I can look that up and give you an answer.
I'm very encouraged by the finding of how small the percentage of the Russians, an even smaller percentage of the Chinese, see the other side as an ally. You know, that's a great comfort, because I was so disappointed that 75% of the Chinese polled, you know, they support China's position because it's in China's interest. And then you look at the finding from Riwi, you know, 28% Chinese see Russia as an ally, 36% Russians see China as an ally. That's a very small percentage. That's almost like the same percentage that is saying China's support for Russia is not in China's interest. That's 25%.
Right.
So I say this is, I'm very encouraged by this, is I think the Chinese people, you know, there is a saying, that, you know, people have 20/20 vision. They know exactly what this relationship is all about. There is no sentimental, there is no emotional attachment between the Russians and the Chinese. Most of the Chinese know all the bad things Tsar regime had done to China. Most of the Chinese, you know, the older generation that Danielle referred to, they understood how disastrous when China adopted the Russian economic mold, when China adopted how the party is going to be supreme. And so I think, you know, if we look at where Chinese public opinion is by combining these two data set, is I think the Chinese believe that supporting Russia is in the interest of China, not because they like Russia's war, not because they like Russia as a country, they like Russian as a people, but because the U.S. is so hostile to China. And in this kind of macro environment, it's better to retain Russia as a friend so that you're not going to end up fighting the U.S. alone.
Yahweh, I think that's exactly right. And it reminds me of something that Sidney Rittenberg, the late Sidney Rittenberg, said to me a few years ago. We were talking to him at his home, his winter home in Phoenix, Arizona. And he said that there's really no love lost between Chinese people and Russian people. They don't have a natural affinity. Chinese certainly don't have a natural affinity to Russians, nor do they have a natural love for the British. But they do have a natural love for Americans. And I've always found that to be the case, that there's so much that unites them. There's so many things about their personalities, for good and for bad, that are the same. Danielle, I want to talk about the last thing before we move on, some of the findings that show a lot of Russian confidence and appear to show strong, you know, solidarity within Russia. There's this result that shows 80% of Russians believe that their side actually has the upper hand over Ukraine, which oddly might be actually more realistic than the 73% of Americans who are convinced that our side, the Ukraine, has the upper hand. I mean, look, Ukraine has had a very impressive showing thus far, for sure, but still, right, you look at the military might of the Russians, it's not over yet, and I worry about the hubris. Anyway, then there's the 42% of Russian respondents, which is much higher than for China or the United States, that agreed with this idea that they should support their country even if they think it is wrong, which I thought was an interesting question to ask. And
it's 48% of Russians. Believe that people should support their country even if their country's actions and policies are in the wrong. Yeah.
Oh my God, it's gone up 6 points. No, just 48%. That's shocking. That actually reminds me of in years ago, my band was in a contract negotiation, and I was the dissenting voice. I said, you know, no, we're going to ruin this deal. Why should we? And one of my bandmates said something like, if we're all going to be, well, there's a vulgar phrase that can, the where the noun is, can be both most awesome and like a stupid ass. So if we're all going to be awesome, let's be awesome together. If we're all going to be dumbasses, let's be dumbasses together. I said, actually, can I say I don't want to be a dumbass with you guys? And I got, was practically kicked out for right. saying that. But
yeah,
that's I'm glad that the number is much smaller for China.
Yeah. And we're going to be the thing that we're going to be doing is tracking these questions. Like we continue to ask them on a daily basis to kind of understand whether, is this going to change? Are the Russians at some point going to not believe that they have the upper hand? Are the Americans going to start to feel like they, are like, so what is actually, because it's shocking to, I think, probably most Americans that 80% of Russians think they have the upper hand, given the media, given the media narrative that, Russia is really struggling.
Yeah. Yeah. I worry about that media narrative, though. I really do. I worry. I mean, it's impressively powerful, certainly. I mean, the discursive power of the Western media has been on ample display throughout this whole thing. Certainly, Zelensky has been heroic. A lot of stuff. It's been pretty great. But
yeah.
All right. Final thoughts, anybody, before we move on? What's next? Yahweh, do you have more research planned? I'm really curious to, I'm just not just for scheduling a show for the next time I have you on, but just.
No, our plan with Riwi is we're going to start this regularized poll of Chinese perception of U.S.-China relations and how they see their image internationally. So, because last November when we talked about it, it's a pilot. We only asked two questions. So it's going to be a more comprehensive one. So we'll do one later this year and then probably another one early next year so that it will be, we'll have more data, more questions will be asked. I think now we have, we're just drafting the questionnaire. There are 13 questions in addition to the gender, income, location data. So we probably will launch this wave later in the summer or in the early fall. So we're working with Riwi and other sponsors, including Committee of 100 and Oxford University China Center, that we're going to do this survey. And we want to regularize it so that just like Danielle's constant, this index, right? So you have tried to catch if there are any changes and how to interpret these changes over time.
I'm delighted to hear that. I'm really, really keen to see the results start rolling out from that. Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, maybe I'll also add that, so in addition to the work that Yahweh and the Carter Center are going to do with Riwi that on these regularized opinion polls of China-U.S. perceptions, so we're also continuing to gather data on the two other indexes I talked about. One is this Cold War II index in Russia, China, and the U.S. perceptions of each other, but also includes real-time economic data. Mm. So, for example, we know that in China, first quarter GDP came out very positive looking, but it's kind of a rear view mirror when you have Omicron and all these lockdowns and so on. And so we're trying to capture in real time, what is consumer spending look like? And we've got that data now for, April. And we're trying to capture, inflation, all kinds of data that are related to, basic economic conditions in China, also in Russia and the US as well simultaneously. And then we also have these continuing gathering of data in these military, in these conflicts. The conflict between China and Taiwan in particular might be interesting to your listeners.
The economic data in China too, obviously. That's fascinating stuff. So let's stay in touch on that. Fantastic. Yeah. Danielle Goldfarb, Yahweh Liu, thank you so much to both of you. And sorry to take up so much time on a weekend evening. I'm sure you have better things to do, but I look forward to having both of you back on the program, together or separately, but either way, for sure. Before I let you go, let's do some recommendations. But first, a quick reminder that if you like the work that we do with the Seneca Podcast, please help us out by subscribing to SubChina's China Access, our daily newsletter. Honestly, I just think it's the best one out there in English, and you'll find it highly readable, super informative. Just go to supchina.com/subscribe. All right, let's move on to recommendations. Yawei, you go first. What do you have for us?
So I have this book to recommend. I don't know if it was recommended before by your other guests. So this is a book by Luke Patey called How China Loses, the pushback against Chinese global ambitions. I like this book because actually I'm teaching a Chinese foreign policy class. I asked my students to use this as one of the two textbooks. The other is China's Wolf Warriors, by the Bloomberg reporter that you talked to before.
Right, Peter Martin. Right.
So I like this book because, I think his conclusion is the world cannot afford to see China lose. You know, if China loses, if China goes back to what it was before, you know, in the initial 30 years after the founding of PRC, or if China shut down again, or if China becomes what we don't want to see, then it's not just miserable for China, it's going to be disaster for the whole world. But then at the same time, he makes the argument that where China is going now certainly is a threat to the international order, to the rule-based environment that all countries should hold China accountable and not to be coerced by China's economic and other sanctions. And so what he's saying is, let's not try to make regime change, but try to push or persuade or convince China there is a better way for you to have your domestic as well as your foreign policies. So that's why I recommend this book.
Yeah, I read Luke's piece, an excerpt, I think it was from the book, in The Wire China. And I had the pleasure of reading it out loud when we were working with them on the China Stories podcast. So I think he's a fantastic writer. I'm looking forward to reading it. Great recommendation. Thanks, Yahweh. Luke Patey, How China Loses. Okay, Danielle, what do you got for us?
So I'm going to recommend a book called Invisible Women. Came out a mm-hmm. couple years ago. Have you read it?
No.
Okay. It's by Caroline Criado Perez, and I'm really focused, fixated on kind of this question of, there's a big emphasis on kind of big data and machine learning to kind of extract the best from big data, mm-hmm. And less of an emphasis on kind of making sure that the data that's underlying, that's going into the models, is actually reflecting reality, and therefore what's coming out is going to give us, better information and better decisions. And what I really like about her book, and I recommend it to everybody, and so far, whenever I speak about it in a room, all the women put their hands up that they've read it. And I want to encourage not just women to read it, everybody to read it, because really it actually shocked me about the fact that, many of these algorithms are based on data that does not include women. Yeah. And yet, everything from where do we, everything from sort of how do we, which sidewalks do we shovel first because of women's transportation patterns, to the way that airbags are designed and so on. And so it was shocking and eye-opening to me as somebody who spends her time thinking about data and data bias and inclusive data and so on. And so I wanted to encourage other people to read it because I really enjoyed it.
Invisible Women by, you said, Carolina Criado Perez, is that right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Fantastic. Thanks. And I will read it. I try to make a point of reading everything that gets recommended. I'm still making my way slowly through it all, but I try my best. So I would like to recommend the book Tokyo Vice, which I started reading right after I started. I started it right after I talked to my colleague, Chang Che, who had recommended it on this show. He had recommended the TV show, the HBO Max series of the same name. The book is the memoir of this remarkable guy named Jake Adelstein, who grew up in, Columbia, Missouri. He's actually a high school classmate or something of Pete Hessler. He, for many years, was a Yomiuri Shinbun reporter writing in Japanese, covering metropolitan crime and really going after the Yakuza, which is just astonishing. It's a riveting book. It's a great story. He actually does not just a fine job of retelling, capturing all the detail and stuff, but it's actually just the right level of self-effacing. that it's not just like, you know, braggadocio from beginning to end. It's quite good. And you should actually go back and read the New Yorker piece that was written about him by Pete Hessler back in I think it was like 2012. As the guy they got to play him on the HBO Max series is, I don't know if you've seen Ansel Elgar, who for my money, he's like the most handsome guy in the world right now. He played Tony in the new Spielberg West Side Story. He's really, really just like physically just magnetic, right? I mean, who wouldn't want to be played by this guy, right? Huge differences, though, between the HBO version of Jake and the physical Jake that's described in Pete's story. It's pretty funny. But the HBO version of the story, it's different for sure. You know, they do a lot, you know, to make it work as a TV show, but it doesn't feel fundamentally dishonest. So I would second my colleague's recommendation of the show as well. It's quite good.
So read right. The book or watch the I started
read
watching
the
series, the HBO series. I watched like two episodes.
The book's great.
The book is better?
I tend to like books better, but they're both fun. They're both it's kind of fun to compare and contrast too, because it's not the same story exactly. I mean, there are, you know, details like, you know, the exam, for example. That's a detail that's kept in there pretty faithfully, including the part about him forgetting or not recognizing that it was a double-sided piece of paper and that there were a bunch of exam questions on the other side. All these details are left in, but there's lots that isn't. A lot of the characters in the book, you can see who they were supposed to be. They're conflations of a bunch of different people from the book,
okay,
and they make it into the movie, but in really good ways, and things that will go kind of tragically, horrifyingly bad if they stay faithful to it. But it's really good, really good. Anyway, thank you so much, Danielle and Yahweh. It was what a pleasure to talk to you both on a Friday night.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
All right.
Have a great weekend.
You too. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced and edited by me, Kaiser Guo. We would be delighted if you would drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com or just give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts, as this really does help people discover the show. Meanwhile, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News, and be sure to check out all the shows in the Seneca Network. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.